Good to be here. Had a good time. Was here yesterday. Got to meet with your staff and your board. That's unusual. Actually, in all my years, I've never had a pulpit that rotates before. So thanks for that new experience. But I digress. So anyway, you got some great leaders. I hope you appreciate them. We do, certainly within the fellowship realm. We know most of them pretty well and enjoy them and appreciate them, and I hope that you do as well. Just before we get going, and we're looking at a well-known story in Exodus 13. If you have a Bible, you can look that up. Just mention, in order to be accountable to you, and that in our fellowship family as a whole, we have about 95 churches and a bunch of agencies. You guys know many of them. But we do have some targets that we're trying to reach by 2022, four specific ones, and just briefly as an update. So we're trying to find 2,500 new leaders that have been developed over that five-year period that we're involved in. We're about 1,000 towards that, and when we say that, that's 1,000 that we know by name, and so that's not like a soft number. It's a pretty hard number of people in our churches. So trying to get 2,500 new leaders, trying to ensure that there's a discipleship plan that's a very holistic one in every church. Before the end of that, we're about 40% of the way towards that. Trying to have 30% more congregations over a five-year period, which is a very, very daunting task that requires God to be in it. So far, we have 8 new churches. We're currently working in Abbotsford, Coquitlam, Kelowna, Chase, looking towards Enderby and some other places as well right now. So we're excited about that in the church planting realm. And we're trying to ensure that every church, every one of our churches, with no exception, sees people coming to Christ in their church every year. And so it's 4 pretty foundational kinds of principles that we're pursuing. And you're part of that. And so when we talk about the fellowship pursuing that, that means you. And that means all of the other 95 churches together saying this is what God has called us to. So thanks for your involvement in that. We don't take that lightly, but we do get animated and occasionally stressed by the goals and trying to reach them. So thanks for your prayers and your involvement in that. So we're looking at a story today in Exodus 13. It's one of the best known stories of the Bible. It's one that many people, if they've never gone to church at all, would still know the story of the Exodus, or where Pharaoh in Egypt, Israel had been there for a long time, and Moses came along is trying to lead them out. And as we look at that, I want to think about that with you in terms of a mystery, and that sometimes God does things in the ways that we don't really expect or don't really understand. I'm a fan of mysteries, some of you perhaps. So how many of you like mysteries? Okay, how many of you never read a mystery? Okay, that's very sad, and God will convict you today. So I grew up with mysteries, so I liked Hardy Boys. I had the whole Hardy Boys set when I was a kid. I don't know if kids today read Hardy Boys or not, but I did, had them all. I also had, although I would never have admitted it to my brothers and would read them under the covers at night with a flashlight, Nancy Drew, who I saw has a series on TV coming out, although I don't know if it would be the same. I'm doubtful. When I look at that, I even read like Tom Swift. Whoever read Tom Swift? Anybody? Yeah, Tom Swift was the best. Those are kind of old school kind of mysteries. Then I got kind of caught into A&E. They had a Sunday night series, I think, called Mysteries to Die For. And so you could watch them, and it would be like Inspector Morse or Frost or Hercule Poirot or Sherlock Holmes or all those kind of things. I would like all of those. I'd suggest that today we don't see that many good mysteries. Not in sort of the old whodunit kind of way. We have supervillains. We have Marvel. We've got superheroes. We have a lot of explosions and rays and zapping and blowing up and magic and all that kind of things, but we don't have like the whodunit kind of mysteries in the same kind of way. But if you like mysteries and you have any experience with them, then you know that there's kind of 3 basics to any mystery plot, any good whodunit, which is you're always looking for who was the bad guy, and it's all about means, opportunity, and motive. And so you're always looking, who had the means, who had the opportunity, who had a motive, and generally that's the bad guy, and that's kind of what you're weaving your way through in that mystery story. And God as well seems to like mysteries. He leaves us wondering in life all the time, wondering what he's doing, why he's doing it, all those kinds of things, enough so that we have sayings like, God moves in what? Mysterious ways. And usually the plot in God's mysteries include us. We're part of the story. We're trying to discover the clues and figure out what God is doing. We're already sure that he has the means, since he's God, should he choose to use them. We're pretty sure he has the opportunity to do what he wants to do if he chooses to create it. The biggest mystery for us with God, most of the time, is what's his motive. Why is God doing what he's doing? And in our journey, our spiritual journey, our walk with God, it's not the how or the when that usually get us, it's the why. Like, why would God do that? Why is God doing that? And I would love to tell you this morning that it's usually got a really easy answer. The fact is, it usually doesn't. It's rarely obvious. It's rarely simple. And yes, there are some times in our lives where we'll understand that this thing that just happened is a direct result of this thing that occurred, or we did, or somebody else did, or a nation did, or whatever that may be, and we can see that correlation. But often, that's not the case. More often than not in our life, we could play the game of life forever, and we still wouldn't be able to say it was Colonel Mustard, you know, in the library with the candlestick holder. We wouldn't get there. And the times when I felt most inadequate in my pastoral life, that is trying to serve in churches, has been when people are going through something and I know they're going to ask me why. It's an inevitable question, it's waiting, and I'm hoping it never comes, but I know it's going to come, and I'm not sure I know how to answer them, and I sort of placate myself and say, well, I'll just tell him we don't always understand God and all the answers, and I know that when I'm finished that conversation, it's going to sound incredibly inadequate and weak. And I've sat, and most of you will have done this as well, sat with people, or maybe yourself, gone through hard times and waited for that question to arise. Within our own staff and fellowship office, we have one gentleman there, some of you know him, Doug Fordham, who's gone through cancer recently a number of times. He just had a PET scan last week. He's waiting again for results from that PET scan to see what they are. My pastor at my home church now, Southridge Fellowship, pastor's name is Brent Chapman. He's also the chair of our regional board. He just went through cancer as of last Christmas. Actually, Christmas Eve, he got told he had cancer. And this year has been going through that process. I meet another guy about once a month right now who's in a church plant with me, Journey Church. And he's a 30-year-old with a 2-year-old son, married, and he just got told he has terminal cancer. And I'm meeting him about every month. And every time I meet him, I'm waiting for this question to come that I can't answer, that I don't know how. In your own church, you could look at this, and so you've gone through a whole series of people preaching, looked online, so they've done a pretty great job. It's a good thing, but still, you kind of wonder, Pastor Jeff is, you know, working through some health issues. Where does that leave you? What's God up to? Why? And when we come to Exodus 13, it's a story that many of us heard. If we grew up in church at all, we heard this story a lot. Even if we didn't, you can see it in some movies, all kinds of things. And it's the story of the Exodus of Israel out of Egypt. And we tell this story often as a great story of what God's done, and that it is, certainly. But it's also a mystery. And I'd like to point out that mystery to you this morning. And if we gave it a title, it might be, you know, the case of the Red Sea quandary. So let's just review a few facts of the case, a bit of background as we come to Exodus 13 and 14. You may remember that Israel is now escaping from Egypt. They have been slaves in Egypt for 430 years, the nation of Israel. They're used to that. That's the world they know. That's what they're comfortable with. And God intervened miraculously. He called Moses into leadership, sent Moses to go confront Pharaoh. You remember the whole 10 plagues thing where there's this competition and Moses will do something and Pharaoh will say, oh, that's pretty good. And then, but maybe my wise men can do that too. And they have this kind of thing until finally God makes his point. Pharaoh says, okay, I'm going to let the people of Israel go. And they start to leave. And that's where we pick that up in Exodus chapter 13, verse 17. We're just going to track a minute where they went. Sounds super boring to you, but we'll come back to it, and maybe it'll be less boring once you understand it. Verse 17 says, when Pharaoh let the people go, God did not lead them on the road through the Philistine country, though that was shorter. Anytime you're reading your Bible and it says, God didn't do this, although it would have been better if he did, you should stop and say, there's something else going on. What's going on? So God didn't lead them on the road through the Philistine country, though that was shorter. For God said, if they face war, they might change their minds and return to Egypt. That was because there was a series of fortresses along the Mediterranean, and they would have had to fight their way through all of those. So God led the people around by the desert road towards the Red Sea. And the Israelites went up out of Egypt armed for battle. If you pick it up in verse 20, it says, after leaving Succoth, they camped at Ethan on the edge of the desert. So they had got out of Egypt, they got to the edge of the desert of Shur. Pick it up again in chapter 14, verse 1. It says, then the Lord said to Moses, tell the Israelites to turn back and encamp near Pi Hahiroth between Migdol and the sea. They're to encamp by the sea directly opposite Baal Zephon. So if you follow that, we can follow the course of the Exodus. Where did God's people go? Here's a fact. The exact route is a matter of continual debate. And so if you read a bunch of commentaries on this, they're not exactly sure, even though they have all that information, to know exactly where it went. What we know is they didn't take the obvious route to the north. We're told, in fact, God didn't take them there, even though that was shorter, because of those series of military fortresses. We know that Israel was feeling pretty good about itself. It left, we're told, in good order. It left armed. It, in fact, got a whole bunch of money and riches to take with them. They were bold. They were filled with joy. We know, because we're told, they got to the edge of the desert of Shur. And they turned around and went back and camped on the western side of a sea. Again, nobody knows exactly what sea. It's called the Red Sea here. Some think it's a place called the Sea of Reeds. Others think it was actually the Gulf of Suez. Some think it was a series of lakes. Not sure when they say the Red Sea, what sea that is, because there isn't really one there called the Red Sea. So they debate that a little bit. Here's another fact. Pharaoh changed his mind. Pharaoh said, go. They went off on this route. And then Pharaoh says, this seems like a bad idea. What was I thinking? Pick it up in verse 5 of Exodus 14. Then the king of Egypt was told, or when the king of Egypt was told that the people had fled, Pharaoh and his officers changed their minds about them and said, what have we done? We've let the Israelites go and we've lost their services. So that's 2 million slaves that they let go. So he had his chariot made ready and took his army with him. He took 600 of the best chariots, along with all the other chariots of Egypt, with officers over all of them. The Lord hardened the heart of Pharaoh, king of Egypt, so that he pursued the Israelites, who were marching out boldly. The Egyptians, all of Pharaoh's horses and chariots and horsemen and troops, pursued the Israelites and overtook them as they camped by the sea near Pi Hahiroth, opposite Baal Zephon. Pharaoh, Egypt, goes after Israel. We're told they had more than slavery in mind again because in the song that they sing in verse 15, the song that refers to what Egypt was saying, it was saying, we're going to go and destroy them all. It was a pretty scary thing. This was the most powerful army in the world, now chasing them, trapping them against this water. And the essential fact in this mystery is that Israel is caught between a desert and a hard place. They're trapped. The east is blocked by water. The west has the Egyptian army. The north is the Egyptian fortresses. South is the desert. They had seen the military power of Egypt. They had seen the oppression and the cruelty of Pharaoh. They knew what Pharaoh did to people, what Egypt did to people. And this army is bearing down on them, and they're terrified. They're trapped. They're confused by the mystery. They're looking for someone to blame. They want to know, why is this happening, and whose fault is it? And so they went to the obvious person to blame, the leader, because it's always the leader's fault. That's the usual suspect. And they look at Moses, they think to themselves, Moses, he had no idea where he's going, he's a typical male, he refused to look at a map, wouldn't listen to his wife, too much pride to stop and ask, we're going around in circles, now we're trapped, we're going to die, it's all his fault, if he listened to his wife, he'd all be fine, all that stuff's going on. And we're told how that went. In verse 10, it says, as Pharaoh approached, the Israelites looked up, and there were Egyptians marching after them. They were terrified, and they cried out to the Lord. And they said to Moses, Or is it because there's no graves in Egypt that you brought us to the desert to die? That was sarcasm. Sarcasm in the Bible. You should underline that. It's a great verse. What have you done to us by bringing us out of Egypt? Why didn't we say to you in Egypt, leave us alone. We'd rather be slaves to the Egyptians. It would have been better for us to serve the Egyptians than to die in the desert. This is all your fault, Moses. Why leaders get paid the big bucks? They take the blame. It's their fault. In this case, completely wrong assumption. And sometimes we read this story and we read it and we say, look, these were a grumbling bunch of people. They didn't appreciate their leader. Sure, Moses led them there, but God, you know, was involved in that. Fact of the matter is, in this case, there was a smoking gun. In this mystery, there's more than just a suspect. We actually know who did it. Exactly who did it. This mysterious way was the direct intent of God. God did this. And God did this on purpose. God led them into this corner. God brought them around in circles. God set them up. So all the terror they were feeling, all the misplaced blame at Moses, was in the wrong place. God did this to them. If it's somebody's fault, it's his. He had the means, he had the opportunity, and apparently he used them. Now, how do we know that for sure? Well, just flip back to chapter 13 with me, verse 21. People are leaving, they're following God, Moses is leading them. It says, by day the Lord went ahead of them in a pillar of cloud to guide them on their way, by night in a pillar of fire to give them light, so that they could travel by day or night. Neither the pillar of cloud by day nor the pillar of fire by night left its place in front of the people. This is what we all want in our relationship with God. Now, typically, we go around, if you'll hear in sermons, we'll say stuff like, okay, whatever you do, you know, here's the five things you do to know what God wants for you, how God's will for your life is, what you should be doing in your life. You know, there's circumstances, there's wisdom of other people, there's prayer, there's all that kind of stuff. What you shouldn't wait for is God to text you. You know, he's not sending you an email. That's not how God works. There's other ways that God works, and you want the Holy Spirit to lead you. And look, here's what's true in this story. They're following a cloud. They're following a pillar of fire in the sky. God is leading them exactly where he wants to lead them. Exactly where he wants to lead them. And it gets worse than that. God brought them to it. That's what we read already in chapter 14, verse 1, that we often miss when we're reading this story, that Israel had already got away. They had escaped. They were already at the desert of Shur and on their way. And God says to Moses, oh, by the way, turn around. Here's where I'd like you to camp. I'd like you to camp by the sea, or camp near Pi Hahiroth, between Migdol and the sea, and camp by the sea directly opposite Baal Zephon, which, in case you didn't notice, which is exactly the words that are used when it says that's where Pharaoh caught them. They were gone, and God brought them back. That's not a thing we often tell our kids in our flannel graph story of the Exodus. This is God's mysterious ways. And often as religious people, we'd like to let God off the hook on difficult things because it creates this disquiet in our faith to think God would ever do that. Would God ever do that to us? Here's the answer, yes. Yes, he would. In fact, he did. We don't get the luxury of saying God didn't do it. He did. So we know who and we know how, and there's only one question left, which is why? What's the motive? Why? And more often than not, that's our question. Why? Why in the world is God doing this? It makes no sense. We've done what God told us to do. We've legitimately pursued him. We followed his cloud. We followed his fire. We followed the wisdom of people. We did what we were taught to do. And our motives were pure. And we're still stuck in a corner with nowhere to turn. How can that even be? Didn't Jesus say that his yoke is light? Didn't he teach us that? Didn't he teach us to trust him? We've honored God. We've lived within our means. We've done the best we could do. We've been generous with our money. We've given to the church, to ministries, to things that God calls, and we're still stuck between a financial rock and a hard place, and we think that's not how it's supposed to work, is it? Doesn't God bless us if we're generous? And we've tried to love. We've been compassionate. We've been caring. We've tried to change in our own life. We've truly pursued God to do that, and we still feel cornered in our marriage. And there seems to be, there's no way out that includes happiness. How could that be? We've shared Christ with our friends. We've done everything they taught us in church. We've loved them. We've engaged them. We've been involved in their life. But when we finally got down to sharing the words of Jesus about the cross, they want nothing more to do with us. Sought to get along with their parents. We've treated them with respect. We've done our best for them we could while they age, and they still just seem to interfere in our life over and over and over. And every time we walk away, there's increased angst. We've lived a pure life, a holy life, a healthy life. We've gone along with the, you know, I don't smoke, drink, or chew. And we still have exactly the same illness as everybody else has. How does that work? What's the point besides eat more fries? Like, what's the point? Or as a church, you risk, you seek to push forward into God's call for you in Campbell River, and then you wonder, like, how are we going through this? How does that work? And it's not a theoretical question. This isn't a question that you go to seminary and you say it's right alongside of how many angels dance on the head of a pin. You know, this is one of those little theory questions. It's not. It's an everyday question for us. Why does God do what God does? And for sure, why does he do it when it seems like he shouldn't do it? It seems contrary to what we believe and think, and we're more often than not told the answer. So the good news in this story, and I would suggest that it's often true for us, the answers to that are in this story, and God gives two in his word as to why he did what he did in this particular story, why he trapped Israel on purpose. There's two answers. They're often true for us today. Now, I'm not going to suggest it's the only reason. I'm not going to suggest it's always the reasons. But I think it's two legitimate reasons, motives of God. And there's two explicitly stated goals in this story about why God does what he does. And the first one, his first motive, if you will, is simply this. God develops the faith of his people. God will develop the faith of his people. And he does whatever it takes to do that. So if you pick up with me again, after the Israelites complained, blamed Moses for everything, Moses picks up and answers them in verse 13 of chapter 14, and he says, "Don't be afraid. Stand firm and you will see the deliverance the Lord will bring you today. The Egyptians you see today, you will never see again. The Lord will fight for you. You need only to be still. Don't be afraid. Stand firm. Watch for your deliverance. God will fight for you. But you need to stop talking." So in this, if you've got an NIV like I do, they kind of sanitize some things, and so they make it politer. And so we say, "Oh, and please be still." And we think it's like, "Be still and know that I'm God." You know, that's what we're doing. No, that's not what he's saying here. And that's not what the Hebrew is saying. If you read it, it's more like, stop talking. Like, stop blaming, looking around, looking for... Sometimes you need to just stop talking and let God work. Less whining, more trusting. Because what's going on in this story has nothing to do with what Israel is doing or even Moses. It's about what God is trying to say, what God is trying to teach. And it's the opposite of our normal response to feeling trapped. So when we feel trapped, we have like the fight or flight response. You know, we're going to argue or we're going to run away. We have this resounding lack of faith. We usually want to try to control everything we can so that we feel like we've got a grip on it all, that nothing's now, if this is a mysterious way, we don't understand what God's doing, if we can just control it. And sometimes God says, just slow down. Slow down. Wasn't the normal response of Israel. It's often not ours. And then this whole series of events happens, and you'll notice as I look at the story, I'm not really reading all those miraculous things. You know that story of how they escape, but short form of it, God tells Moses to get moving, stop standing around, raise up your staff over the water, and he's going to move the cloud behind them, which he did, which blocked the vision of the Egyptians, also brightened it for the Israelites, kept them from panicking, and God performs this massive miracle of opening a path through the sea. And so it's no small task. You have 2 million people who crossed it in 4 or 8 hours or so. The Egyptians chase them through. God causes them to get confused. The chariots start banging into each other. Wheels start flying everywhere. They're caught in the mud. And then he tells them to Moses, now turn around, extend your staff again. The waters flow way back in. Egypt gets wiped out. Miraculous story. We aren't told how it happened. It's not relevant to the story. Here's all we know. God caused a great east wind. That's it. That's what it says. Because it's not the important part of the story. What we know is that in chapter 14, verse 31, it says, when the Israelites saw the great power the Lord displayed against the Egyptians, the people feared the Lord and put their trust in him and in Moses, his servant. When Israel saw what God did, they put their trust in him. And that's the point. God's interested in building our faith. Israel had spent 430 years in Egypt not trusting God. Even when Moses came and said, here, this is what God's leading us to do, they weren't like, ooh, this is a great idea. They took quite a while to say yes to it. And as soon as Israel got out of Egypt, God's saying, you know what? First thing I need to do with these guys, start teaching them faith. So let's trap them next to the Red Sea where a horrible thing will happen to them. That'll be excellent for them. So that they would fear the Lord. The important lesson for us out of it is the end doesn't grow faith, the process does. The end doesn't grow faith, the process does. God is every bit as interested in who we are becoming as he is in where we are going. The end is already sure. After this life has passed and we die and we are eternity, we understand what faith will look like. We understand that our confidence in God will be pure. We will see him clearly, face to face. All of that is true. But between now and then, it's this process where God says, what will it take to grow your faith? The process matters. The point for Israel was never simply to get them out of Egypt into the promised land. It was to have Israel become his promised people, which they weren't. Which they weren't. And the point for us is never for God to put us in a particular place doing a particular thing in a particular way. It's to transform us into a particular kind of people who trust him, who live for him. And we are continually having to learn that faith is not an abstract kind of an idea that's out there somewhere. It's actually something that we have to live into on a regular basis. And this was one step in a whole series of lessons that Israel went through, because the process of growing faith is always long, extremely arduous, usually difficult, and we can't build faith unless we need it. So listen to me. We cannot build faith unless we need faith. And the only way we need faith is when we can no longer count on ourselves. When our budget, our life, our health, our whatever is not going to be enough. It takes God. And that's where our faith will be stretched. That's where our faith will grow. That's the good news. The bad news is once it grows, God says, oh, let's do that again. But if it was this big last time, it better be this big the next time. So God is continually pushing us out of our comfort into discomfort to say, this is what it'll take to grow your faith. And if I have to turn you around and stick you next to the sea of reeds for that to be true, that's what I'm going to do. God is interested in our faith growing. God doesn't always cause the problem, but sometimes he does for our faith. That's one motive. Second motive that we see in this story is that God brought them around, put them next to the sea or Red Sea to protect his own honor, and especially relative to people who were treating him with disdain, specifically Pharaoh. God did it to protect his own honor. So you kind of wonder sometimes, we look at these Old Testament stories and we wonder how God could do what God's doing, because it's pretty graphic and nasty. and we shouldn't sanitize. Yet we're in fact told in verse 29 and 30 that the dead bodies of the Egyptians washed up on shore. That's not a pretty sight. That's not something that attracts us. But I want to suggest we should look at that from two different ways. One of them, we should look at it from an honest life perspective, be a little bit fair with this. So typically when we're talking to people in our culture of tolerance in Canada, people look at this and say, that's a horrible thing. How can a God be like that? How can a loving God do that? I want to just suggest to you, war is always tragic. That's a reality. It has been through all of the history of mankind. If you look in World War II, 50 million dead. That's a reality. That's not something we look at fully in the face, but sometimes we need to. And the Pharaoh that is being dealt with in this story had oppressed the Israelites for 430 years, including the mass genocide of an entire generation of children. That's what's true. And he was prepared to do it again and was coming to kill all of them. We also know he was given 10 chances to change his mind. 10 chances to approach it a different way. So that's one way of looking at it. Another way of looking at it is to look at it from the honoring God kind of perspective. The pharaohs of Egypt viewed themselves as gods. Whether they called themselves the sun god or whatever, they said, I'm a god, I want to be treated like a god. Even in the thing with the 10 plagues, when Moses would go and say, look at what we can do, this is what's going to happen, he'd call for his own wise men, look, I can do the same thing, I'm as much a god as your god. And Pharaoh challenged God directly. I'm every bit as important and worthy of honor as you. And God has no intention ever of sharing his glory with somebody else. Never. It was equally true for Israel, incidentally. So if you remember, it's not very far after this story by Exodus 34 or so. After Israel got to Mount Sinai, the Ten Commandments are given to them. But while Moses is up getting the Ten Commandments, remember that Israel themselves are down below and they decide to build a golden calf and start to worship. And God destroyed every one of them who did that. It was as true for Israel as it ever was for Egypt. And it is as true for us as it was then. And so it'll go on in Exodus 34 in this very famous verse where it says, the Lord, the compassionate and gracious God is slow to anger, abounding in love and faithfulness, maintaining love to thousands. He forgives wickedness, rebellion, and sin, and yet he does not let the guilty go unpunished. We should never discount that God. And from the moment that Pharaoh challenged God, Pharaoh and Egypt were in trouble. So you read this, if you pick it up again, verse chapter 14, verse 4. So God has brought Israel back. He's trapped them next to the sea, Red Sea. And it says, and I will harden Pharaoh's heart, and he will pursue them. But I will gain glory for myself through Pharaoh and his army, and the Egyptians will know that I am the Lord. Why did God do that? And you've read this story, you've probably asked yourself, why would God harden Pharaoh's heart? Because Pharaoh had challenged the glory of God. That's why. If we read on and we look in verse 17 and 18, the same things are said. It says, then I will gain glory through Pharaoh and all his army, through his chariots and his horses. The Egyptians will know that I am the Lord when I gain glory through those things, the Pharaoh, his chariots, his horsemen. If you read on, verse 25, when all this happens and they're caught in between the water, it says, the Egyptians said, let's get away from the Israelites. The Lord is fighting for them against Egypt. And they were beginning to learn that they had challenged God. And we're going to lose from it. 26 times in this story, we're told every chariot, every horseman, the power of Egypt was to no avail. And when Pharaoh claimed the glory that belonged to God, he was literally in over his head. That's a bad pun, but don't quote it. One of the motives for God is that the whole world would know that Israel's God was the Lord of all the earth. Honor belonged to him. And it was never, never Israel that was trapped, which is kind of the thing we miss in this story. We look at it, we say, even when we tell the story to our kids, you know, Israel was in this terrible position. And then if we go a little deeper, we say, oh, ooh, bad news. It looks like God brought them into this terrible position. But it was never Israel that was trapped. It was Egypt. It was Egypt. It was never Egypt's might against Israel's weakness. It was Pharaoh's ego versus God's glory. And God was doing something to prove his honor. So don't undervalue the motive, because we enjoy the love, the justice, the compassion of God. We talk about it, and we should all the time. But we forget sometimes that God is jealous for his own glory. And he doesn't just let things go by, whether in ancient days, in our day-to-day world, or never-ending eternity. God doesn't share his glory, nor does he allow it to be diminished. Say it another way in C.S. Lewis's version expressed in the Narnia series, where he says, Aslan is a tame lion, is not a tame lion, but he is good. We don't get to tame God and say, God can only do this in this way. And the thing to notice in this story is that we read it, and we can read it in about a 10-minute period, start to end, read the entire story, see what happened. We may or may not pick up all those little details. But in God's mysterious ways, Israel never knew what we know. Israel didn't know that. Israel didn't get to read the hints in the story before it ever happened. They didn't get to read how God brought them back. They didn't see all of that. And until the entire episode was over, they never knew what God was doing. They were just caught in this terrible place, terrified and afraid, thinking they were going to die, and trying to figure out what's it all about, while God is stretching their faith and protecting his own honor. But for thousands of years after, still today, if you go to Israel today, the Exodus event is the foundational event in the story of their relationship with Yahweh. Throughout the Old Testament, when you read the Psalms, when you read the other stories, you'll see David and others come back to this event over and over and over and over. This is when we learned that we need to trust in God. This is the event that taught that. And for them and for us, in the middle of it, it's just the mysterious ways of God. We don't know what's going on. We don't see the end. And so when you look in your life and you start to see the different events and start wondering about the mysterious ways that God works, I don't know the end any more than you do. And I expect you don't know the end of a lot of those journeys, difficult journeys that you're walking through. But I know that there is one. Whether that's in this particular story or particular event in your life, whether it's in an hour, or it's a day, or a month, or if it's only in eternity, which I would remind you from Hebrews chapter 11, where it says, faith is the substance of things hoped for, evidence of things not seen. Without faith, it is impossible to please God. Every single person there died without ever seeing the result of their faith. So sometimes it's in eternity. But whatever it is, there is a motive. God's got the means, God's got the opportunity, and he has a motive. And if I were to guess, more often than not, in your life and mine, it will still be about our faith and God's honor, God's glory. We tend to be very task-oriented people. I'm a particularly task-oriented person, looking for the goal, the end. If I start a project, I will just pursue it, because it has to get done. And so it's difficult for me, and maybe for some of you, to get this idea that in our walk of faith, the process is just as important as the end. Process is just as important as the end. And there's all kinds of times when God's going to say, turn back. There's all kinds of times when God's going to say, look, you feel cornered, but this is what you need right now to learn to trust. Sometimes when we're between a rock and a hard place and we just have to cry out to God. So like each of you, I have no idea what God's plan for you exactly is. I don't know what God's exact plan for this church is. Like you, I hope for things, I pray for things, I dream of them. But what I do know, what I would encourage you to go home knowing, is that in God's mysterious ways, whatever else is true, it will be about building your faith and about proclaiming his own glory. Let's pray together.